A world-famous French wine expert was making a tour of America. He was going from one luxury wine cellar to another in order to recork expensive old bottles of wine. Very expensive, I mean thousands and thousands of dollars for each bottle. And over time, this was necessary because corks can deteriorate and lose their elasticity, and then the seal on the bottle may let in air, which would spoil the wine. Some of the bottles are over 100 years old and, of course, cost many thousands of dollars. When the French expert was interviewed by an American journalist about how risky or scary it was to recork such expensive wine bottles, the Frenchman replied, "What is wine anyway but the grape juice on its way to becoming vinegar?" So he took his job seriously, but he wasn't too worried. It was just a routine thing for him. Wisdom, like wine, ought to become better with age. But as my younger brother says, with age comes wisdom, but sometimes age comes alone. Well, what is wisdom anyway? If we look at the Cambridge Dictionary, wisdom is the ability to make good judgments based upon what you've learned from your experience, or wisdom is the knowledge and understanding that gives you this ability. When we think of wisdom from the Bible, we generally think about the book of Proverbs. Well, today we're going to look at Proverbs 30, verses 24 through 28. I've entitled this sermon, Four Little Things on Earth, Wisdom from Proverbs 30. Four Little Things on Earth, Wisdom from Proverbs 30. If we start in Proverbs 30 and verse 24, we're told there are four little things which are little on the earth, but they're exceedingly wise. I find it interesting that the word exceedingly is used to describe wisdom. Not just a regular portion of wisdom, but a whole lot of wisdom. I suppose regular wisdom would be something like, don't put your hand on a hot stove. And most of us have gained that wisdom. Or perhaps we've learned, watch where you're going. Most of us have learned that we can get hurt or suffer pain if we bump into things or fall down. In Proverbs 14, verse 6, we're advised, a scoffer seeks wisdom and doesn't find it, but knowledge is easy to him who understands. What's a scoffer? Somebody who doesn't necessarily have a good opinion of someone or something. Scoffer, he's a skeptic or a cynic. Seeks wisdom and doesn't find it. Knowledge is easy to him who understands. So really we seek understanding to help us to gain wisdom. Of course, the example is famous about Solomon, who asked for wisdom and then pursued it in 2 Chronicles 1 and verse 7. This is the time when King David had died. Solomon was now becoming the new king. In 2 Chronicles 1 and verse 7, that night, God appeared to Solomon and said to him, ask for whatever you want me to give you. You ever thought about finding an old lamp, rubbing it, and the genie comes out and you get three wishes? Stories abound of those. What would you wish for? What do you want? And I've thought of a variety of things over time. Wow, what if I got the lamp and rubbed on it? What could you narrow it down to three wishes? And of course, the clever people, they all want their third wish is to get three more wishes and then keep going from there. But Solomon was asked, whatever you want. And so in verse 8, Solomon answered God, you've shown great kindness to David, my father, and have made me king in his place. Now, Lord God, let your promise to my father David be confirmed, for you have made me king over a people who are as numerous as the dust of the earth. Too many to count. Give me wisdom and knowledge that I may lead this people who is able to govern this great, who is able to govern this great people of yours. He didn't say these great people of mine. He said these great people of yours. Notice God's response in verse 11. God said to Solomon, since this is your heart's desire, and you've not asked for wealth, possessions, or honor, nor for the death of your enemies, and since you've not asked for a long life, but wisdom and knowledge to govern my people over whom I have made you king, therefore wisdom and knowledge will be given to you. Notice those are together, wisdom and knowledge. And I will also give you wealth, possessions, and honor, such as no king who was before you ever had, and none after you, will have. That's a lot. That's a lot. More than anyone has ever had, more than anyone will have. Solomon went on to acknowledge this gift from God and then actively pursued wisdom. And we know that from Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 13. In Ecclesiastes 1:13, "And I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised." So Solomon set out his heart. He says, okay, I want to seek the knowledge and then from that get wisdom. But wisdom isn't just a nice thing to get, but it's a responsibility that Christians must pursue. Let's take a look in Acts chapter 6 and verse 3. In Acts 6 and verse 3. "Therefore, brethren, seek out from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business." Now, this was the time when they needed to add deacons to watch over to help the congregations that were developing. And they said, you have to seek out men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit, but that wasn't it, and wisdom. In other words, those who had accumulated knowledge and were able to make good decisions. So now let's explore what God calls exceedingly wise, as described then in Proverbs 30. We've read Proverbs 30, verse 24. Let's go to verse 25, and this tells us about the ant. Now, there's 4 animals that we're going to read about here today. The first one is the ant. In Proverbs 30, verse 25, "The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their food in the summer." I suspect many of us have watched how ants work. They're tiny, and they seem to be constantly busy. In elementary school, some classrooms would have an ant farm, a special glass enclosure in which the ant colony lives. And then you could watch the ants as they, through the glass, because the glass enclosure would only be 1.5 inches or 2 inches thick. There would be dirt in there, and you could see what the ants were doing in all their little rooms. They would be storing food and feeding the queen ant and taking care of the eggs and so forth. The proverb here notes in verse 25 that the ants were busy preparing food in the summer. The ants simply could enjoy the warmth and the produce of the summer, yet the tiny ants were preparing for the future for such a time that there wouldn't be warmth and when food wouldn't be plentiful. Perhaps some of you read the book entitled Aesop's Fables. It's a collection of stories that attributed to a slave and a storyteller named Aesop somewhere around 600 BC. Each story has a moral or a principle ascribed to it at the end of the story. One particular story is about the ant, entitled The Ant and the Grasshopper. And the fable describes how the diligent ant was working during the summer to prepare food for the winter. And the grasshopper was just out hopping around, enjoying himself and making no such preparation. And then the hungry but lazy grasshopper, when winter comes, begs for food from the ant, and the ant refuses the grasshopper. The situation really sums up the moral lessons about the virtues of hard work, planning for the future. I remember as a young man, I recall my failure to plan ahead, and it caused me a severe problem. Well, one of my brothers stepped in to help me out of the jam, but he also commented, "What have we learned, grasshopper?" Ouch! Apparently he read that Aesop's fable from years before. The ant was busy doing what was important, making good decisions today in order to enjoy a better tomorrow. We often refer to that as someone who does that as being mature. The Cambridge Dictionary says maturity is the state of being mentally and emotionally well developed and therefore responsible. Don't you just hate being responsible all the time? Don't you just wish life would just really work well and you didn't have to be responsible? Yet that's our calling, to be mature, to be responsible. Maturity is also commonly defined as the ability to recognize the benefits of delayed gratification. Delayed gratification. There's an interesting article written The website is startofhappiness.com, and they recount a Stanford University marshmallow experiment. The power of delayed gratification is best known from a Stanford marshmallow experiment conducted by Professor Walter Mischel at Stanford University. In this experiment, the professor studied a group of 4 to 6-year-old children who were given a marshmallow in a room for 15 minutes. They were given the choice of being able to eat the marshmallow now, or if they wait 15 minutes, they'll be able to have 2 marshmallows. Ultimately, some children were able to wait 15 minutes and others were not able to do so. The study didn't finish there, however. The researchers continued to study the development of the children into adolescence. They found that those children who were able to delay gratification were psychologically better adjusted, more dependable persons, more self-motivated, and as high school students scored significantly better with grades. With the latest study conducted on these same participants in 2011, the research shows that the characteristic remained with those individuals for life. The study shows that delaying gratification is a choice of the individual. You can choose to have something now, or you can choose to have something bigger or better at a later time. Delaying gratification improves your willpower, and ultimately you reach your long-term goals faster. Well, the lesson then from the ant is that they all practice the principle of delayed gratification, getting important things done for today so they can enjoy a more comfortable future. And that ant is given to us as an example of being exceedingly wise. Doesn't that kind of lead toward our future in the church? The things that we do today, we know that greater reward will come in the future. The second example is in Proverbs 30, verse 26. We have another animal here, the badger. In Proverbs 36, the rock badgers are a feeble folk, yet they make their homes in crags. It's seemingly impossible to make a home in a pile of rocks, yet the badger is able to make his home where other creatures cannot. He digs among the rocks and he finds a home, a defensible home that serves to protect its young. The badgers don't have strong arms and strong legs, such that they can lift and move the rocks. They search for open spaces among the rocks, and using their strength, feeble strength, to dig out the dirt from among the rocks. I know as a boy on the farm, I would come across holes in the ground where some creature would have dug a tunnel down into a den. And oftentimes the hole was near a pile of rocks. Farmers would methodically, in my area where I grew up, would methodically pick up rocks from the surface of the field and pile them at the end of the field in one big pile. And a rock pile was a convenient place for badgers to dig a den. And while there are badgers where I grew up in Minnesota, the neighboring state of Wisconsin is well known for its badgers. In fact, the nickname for the state of Wisconsin is the Badger State. In the 1820s, the iron ore miners, they dug holes into sides of hills to remove iron ore, and the many holes in the hills reminded people of badger holes. So what's our lesson from the badgers? Lesson from the badgers, they find opportunities where others cannot, and then they establish their own security or safety by taking advantage of what others see as obstacles. Others see the obstacles, they see the opportunity for security and safety, and put their homes there. The third animal that I want to look at are locusts. In Proverbs 30, verse 27, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. Well, locusts are flying, jumping, crawling creatures that similar to a grasshopper. And in the summertime during grain harvest season, when I grew up on the farm, grasshoppers would somehow sense that the grain was ready to harvest, and we'd see grasshoppers everywhere. I remember during harvest, an old neighbor, my dad would do custom combining, harvesting, and go around to some of the neighbors. And there was an old neighbor, he would be, when we're unloading the oats in this case, he would be picking out the grasshoppers and putting them in a quart jar. And I remember as a little boy, what in the world is he going to, why would somebody collect grasshoppers? Well, my dad explained it in one simple sentence, that the old man was going to use grasshoppers for bait for fishing. And so he could turn grasshoppers into something that he could eat. Wasn't going to eat the grasshoppers. During the Great Depression in the 1930s, there was a terrible drought in the Midwest. Lack of rain dried up the land. Several states were so dry that the time and place referred to in the history books is known as the Dust Bowl. Not only was there a lack of rain, crops that did grow were eaten up by swarms and clouds of grasshoppers. My dad said the grasshoppers would eat every green thing in its path. Well, some of you have raised chickens. I know we have a few chickens at home. And it's really quite something to watch chickens chase flying insects, and then they pounce on an insect when that insect will land. Well, my dad told me that in the Depression that the farm chickens delighted in eating grasshoppers. They would run after them. In fact, they had such a good time chasing and eating the grasshoppers. Then they ate so many grasshoppers that the chicken eggs turned green inside and out. The shells were greenish. The egg whites were greenish. The egg yolks were greenish. My dad said it was hard to eat the green eggs. I suspect that the author of Dr. Seuss's children's books, grew up in the Great Depression and perhaps had a green egg experience. The affliction of the locusts was one of the 10 plagues during the time of Moses and the Exodus from Egypt. In Exodus 10 and verses 12 through 14, we read about these locusts, and it tells us in verse 12, and they will eat every herb of the land, all that the hail has left. So an earlier plague had hailed everything down, knocked it down to the ground. Now the locusts came in. It's verse 13, Moses stretched his rod over the land, and the Lord brought an east wind over the land all that day and night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts went up all over the land of Egypt and rested on the territory of Egypt. Well, they don't just sit still. They're going to be eating, constantly eating. If we read on, they were very severe. Well, severe means they had a bad effect. Previously, there had been no such locusts as they, nor shall there ever be such after them. So, basically, they were gobbling up anything that was green in sight. The locusts came in swarms or cloud. They rode in on the wind and carried away by the wind. Let's read, turn to Deuteronomy 28 and verse 15. And in that part of the Bible, we have the blessings and the cursings. The blessings and the cursings. And here's, it's interesting, in verse 28:15, it talks about what happens if you don't listen to God, you don't obey God, you don't do what he says and follow his commandments. In verse 15, but it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, then all of these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And then from verse 15 on down to verse 42, it lists all kinds of things that people bring on themselves. It's not that God really has to do anything. People bring them on themselves. And we get down then to verse 42, and it says, locusts shall consume all your trees and the produce of your land. In other words, it is going to eat up all the living things around. And we've seen that in several cases, whether it's just the Egypt case or in the case of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. Yet in all of this destruction and damage, locusts don't have a commander. The locusts don't have a boss to tell them what to do. They don't have any formal organizational structure. They have no job titles. There's no job descriptions. There's no time clock to punch. No one to tell them to get up and go to work or what to do and when to go home. The locusts simply march together, advancing in ranks or waves, eating everything in their path. I have a small flock of sheep. And when the sheep graze, in the summer you can all watch them and they line up all side by side. And I remember seeing this years before. I thought, well, that's unusual. But they were all bumped side by side and they would form a line. And they would eat like a lawnmower, and they would just graze together, and as they would move slowly forward, they would eat everything that was in the foot or so width in front of them, and they would move together forward. And I can't think about help but draw the comparison to locusts, who would advance also row after row, eating everything before them. So the lesson of the locust is that everyone participates in a cooperative manner to get the job done, without someone telling them what to do. It's sort of like this congregation. Everybody stands up and goes and gets things done, and you don't have to tell people what to do. It's absolutely remarkable. It's following the wisdom that comes from this, of sensing what needs to be done and then doing it, is absolutely marvelous. So we have that lesson of the locust, where people participate in a cooperative manner to get the job done without someone telling them what to do. The fourth example that we have in Proverbs 30 is in Proverbs 30, verse 28. And this is probably the one that makes me twitch the most, and this is the spider. So Proverbs 30, verse 28, the spider skillfully grasps with its hands and is in the king's palaces. Now, I don't know about you. I really don't like spiders. I can intellectually understand the importance in our ecosystem, but I don't appreciate sharing space with spiders. Not in my bedroom, not in my kitchen, not in my house, and not in my car. Especially not in my car. You cannot get out of there fast enough when you're zinging down the highway and a spider comes dropping down or crawling over you. So a number of years ago, when my sister-in-law, who's in Florida, her daughter was getting married, niece was getting married, and so we were there visiting and staying in their house, and I was highly uncomfortable when I discovered they had a fish tank, in what looked like a fish tank, until I discovered they had tarantulas in it. Hard to sleep at night when all somebody has to do is knock the tip off the tarantulas. It made me think of that, the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie with Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones series, where the guy in the South American cave was covered with big, hairy tarantulas. Not my fondest thought. But I realized I really don't know much about spiders. I mean, I never looked them up or studied. Why would this example be here for spiders? So I came up with an interesting website, 10 Facts About Spiders by an Annalise Dubner under ranker.com. And she put together some interesting information and starts out with things that I could quite agree with. Most everyone hates and fears spiders on sight. I can agree, we're starting off really well here. But they're actually some of the most impressive, well-equipped animals on Earth. They are the highest order of predator, built for killing and built for survival. Their amazing adaptive bodies make them some of the most successful carnivores, flesh eaters, on the planet. Over the history of the Earth, they've managed to cover every continent and every environment. There are over 40,000 known species and probably more that we've never seen. How many spiders in the world? Well, it's estimated there are up to 1 million spiders per acre of land on Earth. And in the tropics, the number is closer to 3 million. So let's take a look just a little bit. How do we understand about these spiders? I mean, where's the wisdom here? Right now, I'm still twitching. Well, number one, insect control is what spiders do, and they do it well. They eat more insects than birds and bats combined, so they should be considered then one of humans' best friends. They can play a big role in controlling insect population. If you have two flies, an adult male and an adult female housefly, and they reproduce without limit, and all of their offspring reproduce without limit, and so on and so forth, and they reproduce. At the end of 1 year, those two flies would have produced so many offspring that they would cover the earth 4 to 5 feet thick. So you know the regenerative power here of the flies, and so, which I'm sure have a necessary component in our environment, but the spiders make a control over insects. As a lad growing up on the farm, I remember looking out across an alfalfa field where the grass was, even after it was harvested, when the alfalfa was just a few inches tall, and then you'd look out at the dew in the morning, and the sun would come up and shine on the dew, and you would see thousands and thousands of spider webs, and the dew would be catching on the spider webs. And yet you go walk out there and you don't see them, but you know they're there. So insect control, which, and they wouldn't be there if there wasn't something to eat. So insect control, which is critical. So think about that. If they're ever in your house or your garage or even in my car, that means that they're looking for something to eat. And we should be thankful that they're eating those things so we don't get overrun by those. Another interesting thing about spiders, they have some amazing weaponry. Spiders use their own silk to trap their prey. But sometimes they don't spin the typical web. They can use a sticky blob of silk on the end of a line, like a bola, they call it, like the South American cowboy would use. And they attract their prey in some way with the scent of a pheromone, and then they use this swinging sticky silk with this clump of silk on the end to trap it and wind it up and bring it in. So they do have amazing weaponry. Some spiders also practice fishing. 8 of the world's 109 arachnid families can catch and consume small fish. I didn't need to know this. The spiders can subdue fish 5 times heavier than they are. At least 18 species can actually catch fish. Some spiders can swim, dive, and walk on the water surface. The particular hunters anchor their hind legs to a stone or a plant, and with their front legs resting on the surface of the water, and then patiently wait to ambush their prey. The slightest movement in the water under their legs can spur them into attack. There are several species of spiders that can actually swim underwater and be submerged for 20 minutes to an hour. And what they do is they create a diving bell, a bubble of air around them so they can survive for that long. Spiders also amazing examples of hydraulics. In other words, lever action. Jumping spiders, which is a common type of spider. I really didn't want to know about this either, but jumping spiders, one of the more common type of spiders in the world, have the ability to jump great distances, probably 50 times their own length, which is probably one reason why people really don't like them very well and want to get away with them or squish them. The thing is that spiders don't have a particularly strong muscles in their leg. They use what we would consider to be hydraulic pressure by they squeeze fluids from the body into the legs to make them expand. So just like on using farm or construction equipment, they use hydraulic power. And then there's the spider senses. Spiders, most of them have multiple pairs of eyes. Not just one pair, but multiple pairs. Can you imagine if we had multiple? Well, my mom had multiple pairs, I'm sure of it, because she was always could tell what we were doing. But I called her up this week and apologized for the birthing pangs that I gave her and 65 years of grief. She said, it's okay, you weren't the worst one. I didn't want to ask which of my brothers she was referring to. I just let that one go. But multiple eyes, they usually interact with the world through tactile or feeling sensation. They're covered with little tiny hairs that can sense low-level vibrations on the ground, floor, leaf, or a web, and can pick up vibrations through the air. And unfortunately, some of them can even use their bristles for defense, shooting them off like little missiles. Some spiders form societies. The majority of spiders are aggressive. Well, that I knew figure out. And they're solitary. Yeah, there's only one of them or two of them in one area, and they're aggressive. But about 40 of them have something in common with ants and bees because they're social. They have communities. Generally, they live in tropical parts of the world. Good reason not to go to Brazil. Although I would visit if I had a chance. The colonies can grow large enough to catch this, take down birds and bats as well as large insects. So these spiders, they're pretty efficient. We already know this next point, 7, they're trap builders. A number of species of spiders don't spin webs but run on the ground. Wolf spiders and tarantulas, notably. But some of them build tunnels, funnels, and burrows in order to hide and trap their prey on the ground. These tend to be non-aggressive, but when they're threatened, they rise up on their legs to appear larger and intimidate the predators. And so the trapdoor spiders tend to dwell on the ground, have a burrow, and they line it up with silk so that an animal can fall into the trap. And there's funnel grass spiders and wolf spiders. Number 8 category is a category of spider called bird killers. These are Goliath bird eaters, are the world's largest spiders. I don't think they reside in Arkansas, and I really hope nobody starts them here. The tarantula is a generic name for hairy spiders, but they can have a leg span of 12 inches across, like a big dinner plate, for example. And they do feed on small animals and have been able to kill poisonous snakes. So we have then, and it's interesting, arachnids or spiders have external skeletons, which is their skin or their shell. And when they molt or go through, they split open their old skeleton to grow larger. The new one is soft and pliable for a while they grow, and then it hardens up. Like reptiles, spiders can regrow lost limbs when they regrow a new skeleton. Wouldn't that be nice? You lose a body part, and you can just regrow that one. Well, just move on. I know where I grew up, almost every neighbor was missing something or another. Some body part was gone. We were very careful. We were growing up. Of course, mother was watching us with those extra eyes to make sure that we were careful. There aren't many mentions of spider in the Bible, but there is a particularly instructive verse in Job 8, in verses 13 through 15. In Job 8, 15 through 13, and this is talking about the kind of spider that weaves a web. Verse 13, "So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the hypocrite shall perish, whose confidence shall be cut off, and whose trust is like a spider's web. He leans on his house, but it does not stand. He holds it fast, but it doesn't endure." In other words, trusting in a spider's web? Well, we know that spider webs are flimsy. They're not sturdy. And if we put our trust in a spider's web and then lean on it, we'll likely fall. Spider webs have their place, but they rely on time and chance and not as a sturdy structure. Abandoning God is like trusting a spider's web. There will not be a good outcome. So what is our lesson from all of this about the spider in Proverbs 30, verse 28? And the verse says, "The spider skillfully grasps with its hands, and in its kings and is in kings' palaces." Notice the verse doesn't stop with the mention of the spider skillfully grasping with its hand. It goes on to say the spider is in kings' palaces. It doesn't matter how sophisticated you think your status in life is, such as a king. It doesn't matter how well you think you've built your house. Even if it's a grandiose palace, the spiders will find their way in it. Many years ago, as a consulting manufacturing engineer, I had the opportunity to assist with the construction of a computer disk drive manufacturing plant, building the disk drives that go into computers. And the manufacturing plant had to be super clean at all times. No dust and no insects. So what the plant designer did was he put heating and air conditioning units on the roof and in the center of the plant. And there was such that if there was an outside door was opened, there was positive pressure. There would always be more air pressure inside the plant, and this is the way they still make them, so that if you opened a door, air would come out. And that meant that other things couldn't go in. So there was a constant air pressure inside the plant, and it pushed out or didn't let dust and insects come in. You could start with a dirty plant, or a dirty manufacturing plant, and you would clean it as best you could. And then they would turn on the air pressure. Any dust, it would push it out. Now, my wife and I had a chance to visit some friends who lived in Austin, Texas, a number of years ago, and they were caretakers for a mansion, 10,000 square foot house, 8 bedrooms, 10 bathrooms, movie studio, gaming room, remarkable place. They lived in the caretaker's house. Some oil people lived there 6 months of the year. And the other 6 months of the year, they lived in Vail, Colorado, where they had an 11,000 square foot house. So in the summer, they would live in Colorado. In the winter, they would live in Texas. So they hired a caretaker to take care of the house. And they kept the house at 72 degrees year-round, even when they weren't there, because they could afford to. They had worked hard all their lives and built a fortune in the oil business. And I noticed, as we were given a tour of the house, there was no dust. And I asked our friends, "Do you ever dust the house?" They said, "Never." And they never dust the house. There were no insects and no dust because they kept the positive air pressure just like the manufacturing plant did to force so that no dust or insects would come in. There'd be just a few pounds of extra air pressure that you wouldn't notice it personally, but the dust and the insects would be pushed out. You probably know the expression about your computer. If it isn't working right, and you say, well, it's got a bug in it. I've got to debug the computer. It's a software problem. Well, originally that came from there actually was bugs like warmth, and they like dark, and there actually were bugs in a computer because they like to go there and where you can't see them. And so that's originally from there. But in our houses and our computers and the computer manufacturing, they don't go for that. So really the issue here is, what's the lesson is, how diligent are we to use the resources that we have? Are we as persistent as the spider who can get everywhere? Because the spider, with all of their resources, managed to reproduce around the world and do an enormous job of catching their prey and keeping the world limited on the insects and their other targets. So a lesson from spider is to use our resources, however they're limited, to accomplish our objective. So God gives us four scriptural examples of animals who are exceedingly wise. In Proverbs 30, verse 24, there are four things which are little on the earth. They're not very big, but they're exceedingly wise. Not just a little bit wise, but extraordinarily wise. Verse 25, the ants are a people, not strong, yet they prepare their food in the summer. Well, the lesson of the ant is that he practiced the principle of delayed gratification, getting important things done today so they can enjoy a more comfortable future. The next example in verse 26, the rock badgers are a feeble folk, yet they make their homes in the crags. The lesson of the badger is that they find opportunities where others cannot or will not, and then they establish their own security or safety by taking advantage of what other people see as obstacles. They see the opportunity, other people see the obstacles. In verse 27, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. The lesson of the locust is that everyone participates in a cooperative manner to get the job done without someone telling him what to do. In verse 28, the spider skillfully grasps with its hands and is in kings' palaces. The lesson from the spider is to use our resources, however limited, to accomplish our objective. It is our Christian responsibility to learn wisdom, to make the most of what God has given to us. God has provided some examples from Scripture that can help us to understand what it means to be exceedingly wise. So let's follow the examples of the four little things on earth, the wisdom from Proverbs 30.